Hey, it's Francis Lamb. Thanks so much for downloading this week's podcast. And if you like it, please share it. Leave us a review where you found it. It really helps us out. You can also find recipes and videos and information on just about everything else you hear today on our website, splendidtable.org. But right now, let's get to this week's show. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. A show for curious cooks and eaters. When we were recording in Philadelphia a few weeks ago, we ate so much pork and fried fish and lamb that we kind of felt like, you know, at some point we need to give a little love to some plants, you know? And luckily, Philly is home to one of the best vegan restaurants in the country. It's called Veg, and we showed up at their door for a little lesson on the three things they think everyone should know how to cook by heart. After that, we'll turn to the beloved cookbook author Diana Henry to talk about how to plan a meal around vegetables, and America's Test Kitchen gets into it with their recipe for smashed cucumbers. But first, we're going to hear about giving a little love to plant eaters. What does being a vegetarian have to do with a family's love? Or being gay, or being black or Latino, or being a man? Well, maybe nothing, but for some people, they're all part of the same thing. Discovering who you really are and how people see you. Choya Webb was a young man, a student at my alma mater, the University of Michigan, Go Blue, on the verge of graduating when he decided to come out to his family as a vegetarian. And it got complicated real quick. Producer Renee Gross followed Choya's journey for this story from Gravy, the podcast from the Southern Foodways Alliance.
At home in his apartment in Ann Arbor, Michigan, Choya Webb shifts easily from the serious to the silly and from the political to the goofy and back again. But he dislikes people thinking of him as just another liberal college student going to school in Ann Arbor. And although he doesn't eat meat, he even dislikes the term vegetarian. He says the label comes with too many assumptions.
And you probably do yoga, and I do yoga, and you probably drink coffee at the local coffee shop across from your house, and I don't do that, actually.
Choya is biracial, black and Latino. Part of his family lives in Texas, and the other part lives in Michigan. I met Choya through his boyfriend, Nick. We would hang out in big groups a lot. But it wasn't until we both happened to be on the same long-distance bus trip that we just talked, just the two of us. He told me about his recent decision to stop eating meat. He says he's flirted with the idea for a long time.
I was the typical MySpace kid in seventh grade who found out about vegetarianism and was super thrilled by it and was like, yeah, I'm gonna do this.
But cutting out meat was harder than he thought, especially with his single mom and his grandparents.
I'm not eating meat, but at the same time, McDonald's is right there. We're on our way home. Mom just got out of work at 7. You know, that's what's convenient.
Eventually, Choya decided that giving up meat entirely was near impossible. He became an on-again, off-again vegetarian. Then he went off to college and studied abroad in the Dominican Republic. That's when things changed. Meat was all he ate.
My host mother served me ham every day, at least twice a day.
At first, the food was not a big deal. He was in a new country trying to be a good guest. Then he lost the taste for ham and for meat altogether. But he was worried about going to Houston, Texas, for Thanksgiving. Texas is the home of longhorn steers and beef brisket. It's the home of barbecue and big cuts of meat. It's also the home of Choya's dad. They hadn't been in touch for years.
My dad is a pastor, and already we have some interesting sort of dynamics because of my sexuality.
Choya never told his dad that he's gay, but back in high school, his cousin found out from other kids.
My cousin, who was staunchly Christian at the time, was with fear for my life. Was her direct words, and so she had to tell all of my family members because they were worried about, you know, my salvation.
So his dad knew that his son was interested in men, but there wasn't any discussion about it.
And I was kind of told to sit alone in the sense of, we don't have to talk about it, it's a phase, but we know.
It was assumed that Troy would grow out of it. Fast forward years later to this past Thanksgiving. He hadn't grown out of it. And there was something else he needed to tell his dad.
I texted my dad before I got there to Texas, telling him I was vegetarian.
His dad responded right away.
Immediately, he was saying, you're not going to be able to eat anything, so you're going to have to find somewhere else to eat.
It was a joke, but the message came across clearly.
He was just trying to say that he wasn't really interested in editing the meal at all because of me, the only person who isn't eating meat right now in the family, probably.
Troya says he felt excluded from the rest of his family.
It's a different kind of other. That's an other that they are familiar with, but not someone who they, I guess, would assume would be at our Thanksgiving. Not, there wouldn't be a person not eating meat. It's Thanksgiving. Much like there wouldn't be a gay person in our church because it's a church.
When Troya arrived at his dad's house in Houston for Thanksgiving, there were 10 to 12 dishes on the table, and only two of them were meatless.
Even rice, they added bacon to it, which, I mean, I thought was hilarious.
There are reasons that his family didn't want to acknowledge his diet, says Troya. He assumes his family's thought process went something like this.
Troya is hanging out with a bunch of white friends that he has who are also vegetarian, who just go to Whole Foods and Trader Joe's all the time and go to, you know, restaurants and spend money on, you know, organic, you know, like, I don't even know how else to word it, but organic food or, you know, high quality food, as opposed to my family that doesn't seem in reach to them or something that they would be interested in doing.
To Troya, it felt like not eating meat fit with his family's image of him as different.
This seemingly queer black person who happens to be skinny. Of course, size is completely involved in this. This skinny black gay person who isn't eating meat, of course, that makes sense. I got it now.
Troya stood out in his family as the only one not eating meat. I wanted to talk to his parents and see how they felt. What was it like for them when Troya told him he was not eating meat? Did they see it being related to his masculinity? So I gave Troya a call.
Hey.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Basically, I told Troya about wanting to interview his family.
Let me think about it for a second.
Yeah, so for sure.
It's interesting because, as you know, primarily estranged from my dad.
So. Troya hadn't really been in touch with his dad since Thanksgiving. It was April now. We also talked for a bit about how the interview might go. It was food I wanted to talk to his dad about, I told Troya.
It's very obvious that you don't plan on, like, really referencing my sexuality in any way, which is good because I'm not out to him yet. I actually just wrote him a letter that I haven't sent. I actually feel quite urgent about this issue because I have they're coming for graduation. They're about to meet Nick.
Remember that Nick is Troya's boyfriend. He was planning a gathering with Nick and his whole family when they came into town for graduation. I perked up when I heard that. I asked Troya if I could interview his dad on graduation day.
Like, I don't think that would be a problem, especially by that point. Because by that point, ideally on May 3rd, he'll know, he'll be okay with it, he'll meet Nick, everything will be fine.
I knew I was going to wait to talk to Troya's dad till graduation, but his mom said she would be willing to talk to me anytime.
I am Benita Comas.
Benita is half black and half Mexican. She raised Troya among her Mexican family. She says in her family, everyone relates to each other with food.
Food in our household was definitely its own language, dialect even. I mean, if you want. I mean, you know, again, because if somebody wanted to tell you they loved you but could not put it into words, guess what? They stuffed your face.
People didn't just use food to say, I love you. They used it for every emotion, including anger. Benita knows this from firsthand experience.
I mean, it became a push-pull in a rebellious stage for me, especially in my teen years. Like, no, I don't want to eat that just because I don't feel like it. And then the person get mad, but that was the goal.
So if you're angry at somebody else, you turn down their cooking. Benita was clear that people only refused food to express their emotions, not because they were on a specific diet. Nobody made different dishes. It was either you eat what I make you or you don't eat at all. So when Choya said he wasn't going to eat meat, it was a big ordeal.
Such and such is probably going to get upset that he's not eating, and then they're going to comment on the fact that he's skinnier than cousin such and such, and then we're going to a whole big spiel. I mean, you could talk for hours with some of these people.
The situation would get so uncomfortable that Benita would sometimes warn Choya not to come to family events.
So sometimes you might have to hide Choya out, you know? You might have to say, you know, such and such is coming over today and they're going to bring over a tray of beef nachos. You might want to make yourself scarce or maybe even go visit a friend.
Benita says most men in their family will go out of their way to eat meat, even when it's not supposed to be in the meal.
Now, don't get me wrong, like the cheese and onion enchilada, right? It's meant to be just cheese and onion. However, you might find Uncle Ralph throwing on cube beef on top of this cheese and onion enchilada dish. Why? Because I eat meat, you know. I gotta have something. I gotta have some cube beef. Meat in that household, it oozes machismo.
If eating meat means masculinity, then not eating meat means the opposite. Benita doesn't think the connection between being vegetarian and dating men would be lost on anyone in her family.
It all makes sense. You know, if they were to really think about it and think about when Choya stopped eating meat or when he started to alter things, they would definitely say, see, we would have known then.
Benita used to worry about her relatives' reactions. She was scared when Choya came out as gay.
It was what everybody else thought, and not even just so much so being in the ethnic household, but the single-parent household.
Benita was afraid that people would see Choya's sexuality as a reflection on her. If only she had a husband. If only Choya had a bigger male influence growing up. Then maybe he wouldn't be gay. But once she realized that her worries all had to do with other people, things changed.
You know, I sat myself down, and once I made peace, I was fine with it. I'm very supportive, you know. Choya was happy. I liked who he was.
Benita's not afraid anymore to tell her family that Choya is gay. But she says for some relatives, she may start by telling them he's vegetarian.
We'll be back in a minute with more of Choya's story about coming out meatless. And then we head over to the chefs at Veg for a vegan installment of our series, The Key 3. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters, and I'm your host, Francis Lamb. We're talking about eating vegetarian today, and we're coming back into a story about a young man's journey of coming out as a vegetarian to his family. And as we rejoin them here, we hear what Choya's mother, Bonita, thinks meatlessness says about her son.
In joking with some of my uncles or something like that, I might say, well, you should have known something was, you know, abound because he stopped eating meat at 14, you know, just because, again, it's easier. You can joke about the no meat, but, you know, when you speak about sexuality, you can only joke so far.
Sexuality was still a tense issue. At least I knew it was with Choya and his father. Graduation was a couple days away. I still hadn't heard from Choya about what was going on yet.
Hey, Choya.
Hi, how are you?
Choya gave me an update. Things with his dad were still unclear.
I came out to him and he didn't really respond. So I really don't know where he's at. It's okay. I just don't know where he's at mentally.
I didn't want to push for a private interview with Choya's father. So I asked if there was another part of graduation that I could come and record.
So we're going to dinner, actually, after graduation. That'll be in Ipsy, so it won't be nearly as crazy. I would not mind if you came at all. It actually would be the most neutral situation, I think.
Later, Choya texted me the details. I got ready to meet all of his family at their celebratory dinner.
Can I get just the flauta special, please?
Excuse me?
Flautas?
Chicken or bean?
Bean, please.
I arrived at La Fiesta Mexicana around 1 p.m. to celebrate Choya's graduation. I realized very quickly there were two sides to the table. Benita explained it for me.
We're separated, but not segregated. There you go.
Well, on one end of the table was Choya's mother's side of the family.
I'm his aunt, Alex. It's Grandma Pam.
Grandma Pam.
I'm boyfriend Nick.
And that's Mama Benita.
And on the other end was Choya's dad's side.
I'm Choya's grandmother, his dad's mom.
I'm Fred Irving, I'm his cousin.
Finally, I got to Choya's dad.
I'm Choya Webb Sr., I'm his dad, and yes, I eat meat.
They all do. When I asked why, his cousin jumped in.
Because we're healthy, and that's why. Something that it's an enjoyment.
As for Choya Sr., being a vegetarian never crossed his mind. It didn't fit with his image of himself.
When you say vegetarian, I think of somebody that's skinny, somebody that's a little eccentric, somebody that just abhors the very thought of their teeth tearing apart flesh or eating anything that once had a mother.
Choya Sr. says his love for eating meat can be traced back to his mom, Lucille, who just happened to be sitting right beside him.
I guess I'm the guilty party with the meat for every meal, and sometimes two meats.
Lucille seemed to pinpoint what everyone else was hinting at. Choya's reasons to stop eating meat came from outside of the family.
Well, I felt that it was because of the environment he was in. The school that he attended, the kids in that school, a lot of them were eccentric. They were different. These are the people he was around all the time. It didn't bother me. I didn't think it was going to last. But it's been years now.
And here's where it gets interesting. Lucille starts talking about that one Thanksgiving. She mentions how much meat they had.
Like, we were at his dad's for Thanksgiving, and we had everything, didn't we? Everything. I didn't know he didn't eat any meat that day.
But then Lucille starts talking about her admiration for Choya's willpower. That's the moment she gets emotional.
He's really disciplined himself, so I'm proud of him. I'm really proud of him.
I knew Lucille wasn't just talking about Choya's ability to forego meat at Thanksgiving. She was talking about her pride for him graduating. And maybe that was the point. It was Choya's willpower that allowed him to be a vegetarian. The exact same willpower that made him succeed as a student. And his dad saw it the same way.
And I commend his discipline to abstain from eating meat.
Choya showed that his decision to go meatless wasn't a fluke. Similarly, being gay was not a phase. He feels like he finally convinced his family of that.
I think they were ready to believe me, or they were ready to really take what I had to say seriously and how I identify and how I kind of perceive myself. I think the whole narrative for them was, oh, he's just confused. And I think a lot of other people growing up in that kind of context hear that throughout their whole life. I knew that now it wouldn't seem like confusion. It would seem like, oh, he knows. He has known. He's an accomplished person, so he knows what he wants and who he is.
It seemed to Choya that his dad accepted his sexuality, but that doesn't mean his dad ever brought it up during the time he was in town.
I feel like his way of talking about it was being nice, being loving, being himself, and that was enough.
Choya was especially touched by the way his dad introduced himself to Nick. It happened right after the graduation ceremony. It was the first time Choya and his dad had seen each other since Thanksgiving.
And, I hugged him, and I hugged my stepmom and my little sister, and then after hugging all of them, he went right over to Nick and said, "You must be Nick," and shook his hand, and it was like the most relieving feeling ever, and even my mom like raised her eyebrows and was like, "Oh." Wasn't expecting that at all.
After graduation, his dad invited Choya and Nick out to ice cream. Choya said it's actions like these that let him know everything was all right. Sometimes, when you don't have the words to tell someone you love them, you do the next best thing. You stuff their face.
That story was from an episode of the podcast Gravy, from our dear friends, the Southern Foodways Alliance. Renee Gross was the producer, and to learn more about Gravy, the podcast, or Gravy, the terrific print quarterly, visit southernfoodways.org. Of course, vegetarianism isn't always about enormous identity shifts or even huge lifestyle changes. You know, I think more and more people are enjoying one vegetarian day or even just a meal a week. But Whether you do it for health or the environment or honestly just the pleasure of exploring the plant world, I think a lot of us can use some fresh ideas for making a meal out of them. So that's the goal for the rest of this hour. Rich Landau and Kate Jacoby are the chef owners of Veg, a vegan restaurant in Philadelphia. Now, it's not what you might think of when you hear the words vegan restaurant. Like, it's not bike messengers and hippie throwbacks. It's just great cooking with plants. In fact, they were finalists for the James Beard Award this year. And when we met with them in their restaurant one morning, you know, when the staff were just trickling in and the fridge compressors were humming. I'm sorry, you're going to hear that a little bit in the background. But we got with them to talk about the three key vegan recipes they think everyone should be able to make, you know, just pull out of your back pocket at any time. So I got straight to the point and asked them to give us their list.
So really we're here today to talk about our key three segment, which, you know, we come around to cooks that we love and admire and we ask them a very basic question. So what are the three things you think everyone should know how to make?
So hard to narrow that down. Just I'm going with custard. So simple, right?
Yeah.
I use a coconut milk, or you could use any plant milk.
Like oat milk or almond milk.
You could, yeah, anything. I mean, there are like 10,000 of them to choose from these days.
Yeah.
But anyway, I use coconut milk because it's so rich and creamy. It's a great canvas for just about any kind of flavor you want to jump into. And that's my go-to. I use it a ton in a lot of different pastry things, but it can be done very simply.
Yeah.
And then, Rich, you had two that you boiled down to, right?
So this is, I think about what I do at home. I like to consider myself a normal person who works 14 hours a day, 7 days a week.
No chef is a normal person.
Other than that, I'm perfectly normal. I come home and I look in the refrigerator. Contrary to popular belief, chefs really don't cook a lot at home. We don't make ourselves these elaborate feasts. What we do like to do is eat to fuel ourselves so we continue to cook.
For other people.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, I'm a big fan of making things that you have for 3 to 4 days, maybe even a week,
sure,
in your house.
Totally.
That you can just use real quickly to make whatever you're making that much better.
Oh my God, first, I have a 2-year-old, so that's my whole life.
Oh, you do?
Like,
oh,
everything on Sunday, put it in the fridge, and like, eat it through the week.
There you go. Okay, so you're already in this mindset.
Yeah.
So my first go-to one goes back to my childhood. I used to love tuna fish salad.
Yeah.
You know, like almost everyone does. And I'd make it for myself on Sunday, like you said, and just eat it all week long. My alternative to that is a chickpea tuna salad. You just take chickpeas out of the can, and there's two ways to do it. You can take a potato masher and just kind of crush them, or you can put them in a food processor and just pulse about 4 or 5 times to kind of break them down a little bit. You don't want to make hummus. Then you've gone too far.
Right.
Celery, onion, pickles, vegan mayo, a little bit of mustard, and then whatever seasonings you had in your childhood, don't reinvent it.
Yeah.
you want to get that comfort food kind of hit.
Totally.
So for me, that's Old Bay dried oregano and lots of black pepper and a little salt.
That's a classy tuna salad when you were a kid.
Like, oh, it's
that's
perfect. I mean, and then you put in the key is don't eat it right away. You're going to be tempted. You just got to find an apple or something. You got to let it sit in the fridge for a couple hours. And then you have it all week long. That's a really simple thing. Also, you know, you don't be bound to chickpeas. You can do it with hearts of palm. You can do it with artichokes. Anything canned. Like cat food.
It'll give you for that canned flavor. Cat food, still not vegan, but sure.
Who knows, right?
It's funny that the taste of our childhood came from a can. But, you know, that was the 70s and 80s for you.
But that's about convenience, you know?
Yeah,
and that's one of the
yeah.
reasons we wanted to kind of put that out there. It's so easy, and yet it's so delicious. So.
Yeah.
So our third pick for our easy go-to is a stock. And I'm going to show you how to make this one, actually, right now. This is called a dashi. Now, in Japanese cooking, dashi is made from fish and kombu seaweed.
Yeah.
So obviously we're not going to use the fish, and this isn't everything in Japanese cooking. So, you know, it's in all their stocks and all their sauces. It's actually very hard to eat vegetarian there. We make ours with kombu and dried shiitake mushrooms instead
of the fish.
Yep. Now, what we have a little boiling water here. What we're going to do is just kind of fold this giant, massive sea vegetable in here.
Yeah.
Now, it has to be kombu. Other seaweeds won't work for this.
Okay,
you know, there's tons of them out there. You know, everyone, you know, probably has nori at home these days. It's got to be kombu. And the particular brand I like is, it's called Kombu Dashi, or Dashi Kombu. If you look for that on the package, that has all these natural kind of like umami flavors going on in there. Yeah. It just kind of fill your mouth up, you know, when you're eating it. And you basically feel like you're eating so much more than just the stock.
Yeah, it has like almost like a natural gelatin a little bit. Like the dashi comes out very light, but you can see a sort of body comes off of it.
Absolutely. You know your stuff.
Yeah.
So we have our dried shiitakes now. It's important to use the dried. If you do a fresh round, throw some in, but you gotta have the dried as well. Mm-hmm. It's just like a dried herb. It's almost like this concentration of flavor going on in there. The fresh mushrooms have all their water in them still. They just don't have the deep concentration of flavor.
Yeah.
So we're just gonna simmer these, and this is just so easy, and your house is gonna smell just amazing after this. Now, we do need a little bit of soy sauce in there, okay? We use a gluten-free tamari for this so that everyone can eat it.
Okay.
And the trick is just simmer away. Now, you can make this more of an elaborate stock. I kind of like to make this seasonal. So in the spring, I like to add celery leaves.
Wait, so time out. So like what we have in here right now, just the kombu, the dried shiitake, and the soy sauce. Like that's it.
You're talking
about like you can add to it if you want.
If you want. You can get as crazy as you want. If you have some onion trimmings, some celery leaves, some kale stems, some broccoli stems, it will only make it better. But this is your basic. And if you don't have any fresh produce, these items are dried in your pantry and they'll last for months and months.
Forever, yeah.
Exactly.
It's
so,
already smelling so good.
Isn't that great?
And it's crazy because I've made dashi at home with the traditional way, with the kombu and with the bonito flakes, the fish flakes. And it smells, it's a wonderful flavor, but it's very saline, it's very sea tasting, sea smelling. Here with the shiitakes, it's
a little earthy.
Yeah, it's a little earthy. It's also like forest and the ocean, right? So you have this like really round
surf and turf.
Yeah.
Right there. Surf and turf stock.
This beautiful, complex flavor.
Now what you can do with this, I mean, there's no end. Now, if you want to make a basic miso soup, this is your base for a miso soup. Stir miso, a little tofu, a little scallion, you're done. Kate and I eat noodle bowls for breakfast. After we took several trips to Asia, and we will never touch an American breakfast again. So we eat noodle bowls almost every morning for breakfast. If you're making any kind of stir fry, if you want to use this in your mainstream Western or European cooking, just use a little bit. And just a little bit in the foundation, it won't taste Asian, but you'll be adding all this umami underneath of it. And it just creates that foundation of flavor, that kind of that X factor that vegans are missing when they're eating.
Yes.
This, I mean, believe it or not, this is almost done. You need a good 12 minutes with it. No more than 20.
Super fast.
Yeah, after that, you're just kind of wasting it. You're boiling it down and concentrating it too much.
So our 12-minute simmer is done. It smells amazing, the kombu dashi. And we're going to make a noodle bowl for us.
Absolutely, sure. So we're using cooked soba noodles here. These are Japanese buckwheat noodles.
Yeah.
Use whatever you have that's easy. Now, if you have leftover spaghetti in your fridge, use that. You have really quick-cooked noodles, like rice noodles, that you can make in just a second by pouring boiling water over them. And it doesn't have to be this big elaborate thing.
Sure.
This should make you happy. This shouldn't be work. Now, I'm going to go right into this dashi pot here while it's cooking. And we're just going to ladle. Look at that color, first of all, right?
Yeah,
like that kind of amber root beer brown.
It's gorgeous.
Right, it really is like a tea. We're just going to pour some of that over our noodles. And
it smells so good.
Smells so good. It just has
now,
some body.
We're going to garnish this with just things I found around the kitchen, and you do the same at home for things you have around the kitchen. We have some pea leaves here. Okay, these are fresh pea leaves. It's springtime now. Of course, asparagus and spring are synonymous, so a little freshly shaved asparagus, and we'll kind of get that into the dashi, let the heat just kind of lightly wilt them and activate them there.
You have these shaved like super thin, like a vegetable peeler.
So shaved asparagus, we're just going to let that lightly wilt into the dashi here.
It looks super chefy, but all you need is a vegetable peeler.
There's some edamame beans here, of course.
Very nice.
Essential. These are pickled mushrooms. We're going to add a little kind of zing to it here.
Okay.
We have some tofu here. This has also been pickled with a little bit of turmeric and ginger.
Oh, cool.
And look at that cool effect going on right there.
Yeah, it looks super yellow. It almost looks like a little omelet square.
Yeah.
There you go. Tamago. We call it tofu tamago. Oh,
funny.
And there is some nori to finish it up. Right there. A little bit of fresh nori. And our last little touch will be just a pinch of sesame seeds.
Beautiful.
And there is like a bowl from whatever you have lying around the house.
Yeah. I love that.
Put together, that is a breakfast or lunch or dinner.
Yeah, anytime.
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 With the stock that you took 15 minutes out of your day to make that you'll have around all week long.
Yeah, and you're going to feel fantastic after eating
this. Oh my God, yeah. Yeah.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for having us.
Our pleasure.
This is delicious. And I'm going to start sleeping.
Do it.
That was Rich Landau and Kate Jacoby, the chefs of Veg, V Street, and Whiz Kid restaurants in Philadelphia. Oh, and Fancy Radish in Washington, D.C. That just opened the day we got there. And you can find their recipes for shiitake dashi, chickpea tuna salad, and summer corn custard on our website, splendidtable.org. Okay, let's talk. You can get to us any way you like. Call us 1-800-537-5252 over on Facebook or Twitter, or you can always email us contact@splendidtable.org. We have Chris calling in. Hey, Chris, where are you calling from?
Hi, Francis. I'm calling from Madison, Wisconsin.
Oh, right on. I went to Michigan, but we like you anyway. What can we talk about?
I'd love to talk about spinach today. The Madison Farmers Market has spinach, but I love eating spinach, both cooked and raw. But one thing that I always run into is when I cook it or saute it, it always has like a kind of leftover dry, chalky feeling that's in your mouth and just kind of sticks to the back of your teeth. So I'm wondering what kind of things you can do to prevent that.
This is a great question. It's one I've struggled with for many years. And the answer is I don't really know.
Oh, man.
So I've looked into it in the past. I believe it's because spinach has a lot of oxalic acid. I say that like I know what it means. I just know the word for it. Swiss chard is another green that has that. You know, a lot of dark leafy greens will have it. And something happens when it combines with, I think, the calcium, maybe just on your teeth or something like that. But it there's some chemical combination that makes the oxalic acid like sort of attach itself to your teeth. So if it has that weird feeling that it eventually goes away. It's not dangerous. It's not a bad thing. It's just sort of part of its natural state of being. I find it's more pronounced when I have lightly sauteed it or just wilted the greens rather than braised it and really cooked it down. So I think something about cooking it down or maybe cooking in a lot of liquid will remove some of that oxalic acid. Maybe if you blanch the spinach rather than just saute it directly in the pan. But of course, you know, you're also taking some other things. Some of the nutrients get lost in blanching water or whatever, but you know, it's still good for you to eat. So maybe I would try blanching it. I feel like that helps to some degree. I do think a long braise, like you would do maybe like southern collard greens, cooking them for a long time in stock or broth or water, seems to get rid of some of it. And I've heard people say lemon, and that's like a natural accompaniment for spinach anyway. I'm not sure that does anything because it's also an acid and the oxalic acid is an acid. So I don't know that that actually takes it away. But considering it's an acid, I think, well, maybe adding a base might neutralize that acid.
Maybe. Yeah, I usually try like lemon and butter is a good combo or red wine vinegar, but I still haven't quite found a solution other than cooking it in a curry or creaming it.
Yeah, exactly, right? That long cooking seems to help it. But if you want to do like a quick cook, a quick saute or something like that, I would try, don't use a whole lot. I mean, like just a tiny bit, like a pinch, a small pinch of baking soda. Because it's a base and the oxalic acid is an acid. You know, bases and acids combine and they neutralize each other. So maybe that will help. And the other thing, actually, baking soda I know will do, it'll keep the spinach super crazy green when you cook it.
Ooh, awesome. Great suggestion. I'll definitely give it a try.
Yeah, give it a shot and let us know how it goes.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot, Francis.
All right. Thanks for the call, Chris. Coming up, more conversation with you and advice from the heralded British food writer Diana Henry on how to make meals out of vegetables. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. And we're back to keep talking to all y'all. Remember, we love it when you go old school and call us 1-800-537-5252, or if you would prefer, Facebook or Twitter. All right, we have Claire from Oregon. Hey, Claire, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. What can we talk about today?
Last summer, I preserved a bunch of fruit by making drinking vinegar. And the vinegar itself was my primary goal. But I have all this fruit in these jars. And the fruit itself is still, you know, perfectly good fruit, but it's so vinegary that I don't know what to do with it. I hate to throw it away because there's so much of it.
Sure.
But well, I would love...
How much did you make?
Probably 4 or 5 quarts, which, you know, for a jam or something like that isn't so much, but the intensity of the vinegar in these fruits, there's strawberries and raspberries and blueberries and stone fruits, so it's kind of a lot of different things.
Yeah. And you made them all separately, so like a strawberry vinegar and a raspberry vinegar and a...
Right.
Oh, right on. And you said they were drinking vinegar. So how do you like to use them?
The drinking vinegars.
Sorry, I know you called to ask me a question. I'm just turning around on you.
That's okay. I use the drinking vinegars as sort of an alternative to a cocktail. Like if I'm not wanting to have alcohol, but I still want to have the ceremony of a drink or something, then I can have a drinking vinegar with, you know, mix it with a soda water or something, and maybe a splash of a syrup, and then it's just delightful.
Nice. Okay, cool. So there's my first clue, I think, for you for what to do with the fruit now that it's left over, right? So you like to mix the vinegar with soda and maybe a little syrup. So I would think about that. I would think about that idea of balancing the tartness in the fruit that's left over in the jars with some sort of sweetener.
Okay.
And, you know, I don't know if you like mash them or if they're like sort of whole pieces or, you know, probably over a few months in the vinegar, they may have started to like soften and
yeah, they're whole, bit, but they are quite squishy.
Yeah, you know, it's all right. They're relaxed, is what they are. The fruit is really
relaxed.
They're super chill. I would think a couple things. I mean, like for me, it sounds like you could certainly mash them up. Like if they're going that direction, you can take them out and with like a potato masher, just go meh, you know, and so they're squished up. And then I would maybe taste that and see if you can't balance it out with honey or a syrup, like a maple syrup or a cane syrup or even if you just want to use simple syrup and just balance that tartness so it's not hot and burning. Like a nice mellow sweetness to sort of round it out. And from there, I would think certainly you can use it in place of like a really loose jam on your toast, if you want to use it that way in a super simple way, or maybe even whip a little bit of it into softened butter as a nice little spread for toast. That sounds tasty to me. I kind of feel like anything is good on ice cream. Like, I don't know if that's because ice cream is so good or like things are just good with ice cream or if it's just like an excuse to eat other things. Like, well, you put it with ice cream, you're going to eat it. But that sounds like a really cool topping for like a nice, like a, you know, whatever ice cream you want. But I could certainly see a vanilla for sure. But even if you have like a berry, maybe try it with like a mint ice cream. You know, it might, you know, just a little bit to give a little spark and that mint flavor will kind of carry you through. So I would think mostly about balancing the tartness of those macerated vinegar infused fruits with sweetness and some kind of fat. And I would just run with it from there.
All right.
Cool.
Great.
Well, try it out and let me know what you think.
Yeah, I will. Thank you very much.
Right on. Thanks so much for the call.
Absolutely.
And remember, you can always call us with questions or thoughts anytime. 1-800-537-5252. So Diana Henry is one of Britain's most admired cooks. She's written 10 books, and her new one is as much about planning a meal as it is about, you know, braising chicken. So the New York Times' Melissa Clark talked with her about how she takes her ideas for composing meals and applies them to vegetables without the big beef roast to go with them. And I gotta say, as a person who's like regularly sitting on Tupperwares of roasted broccoli and carrots in my fridge with no idea of what to do with them, this was a great thing for me to hear.
So your new book is all about menu planning. tell us, how do you plan a menu around vegetables? Because I know this is one of your favorite things to do.
I think you have to think about vegetables in the same way that you might think about meat or fish, in that it's very easy, and I love them too. We think about roast vegetables as the most obvious thing to do these days. But I think you need to think about things that you might poach, things that you might griddle, as well as roast. So it's a matter of thinking about techniques a bit. Also, because meat and fish are such centerpieces, I tend to think of dishes that I can serve on a platter, because then it's quite, I hate this word, but it's a statement dish if you do that. But honestly, when I think about meals, I rarely think, oh, I'll do a vegetarian meal or I'll do one that's with meat or fish. They tend to just come into my head and I think, oh, yeah, that's great. I'll go with that.
Okay, so tell me about the statement dish, the idea of that. What do you mean? And how do you put it together?
I think when it comes to vegetables, you have to think of things that will, you're not just thinking of one big bit of meat. So you're thinking of dishes that have slightly different textures in and that also might have a dressing. Because when we think about meat, we think about things on the side. When we think about vegetables, we tend, or we have thought of that in terms of side dishes. So, for example, in the book that I've just written, there is a platter of roasted fennel with tomatoes and chickpeas, and you do those all separately so that they stay apart. You don't have this platter of vegetables that kind of like softened down to nothing. They still have structure. And then with that, that's got a dressing that has got preserved lemons in it, bit of honey, vinegar, olive oil. And then on the side, I'll put couscous with that or flatbread, and then probably serve something like Greek yogurt with just grated garlic in it, or feta or something. So I'm thinking of building it up. But the main dish does have to take a little bit more thought than just a hunk of meat. But I don't think it's difficult once you think about, you know, I think you should think about accessorizing vegetables just the way we do about accessorizing bits of meat and fish. The other thing about doing vegetables at this time of year, vegetable dishes are better prepared in advance. I was talking to Yotam Ottolenghi recently, and I said, why did you go so vegetable-centric when you opened your places? And it wasn't to do with the love of vegetables, funny enough. It was to do with the fact that when it, the display at the front of his restaurants, you can leave vegetables out there, you know, for kind of like a couple of hours, and they still look great and they're still perfectly good to serve. It wasn't because he wanted to serve vegetables. It was because you can prepare those in advance and they're still fine to serve and they still look great. So I thought that was interesting.
That is such a great thing about vegetables, is they taste just as good at room temperature, so you can make them ahead. Let's talk about seasonal cooking, because that's what chefs are always thinking about. How do you cook more seasonally? I know home cooks want to start doing that too. And when, you know, really, when you think about seasonal cooking, you really are thinking about cooking with vegetables, because, you know, fish and meat are more year-round, and vegetables are actually what it comes in and out of season.
I really noticed this the first time I went to France when I was a teenager. That's when I, and it's really funny because they are so meat focused, but that's when I really noticed them putting vegetables in a way that we didn't do at home. First of all, every meal started with radishes, and they're great from the spring, you know, right through round to October. So we'd always have those. And then, you know, they just called it crudité variée. And now, you know, when we say crudité, we mean those really kind of like dried carrots with really substandard dips. But what they meant was, in the winter, when I was ever there in the winter with that family, they had carrot râpé, so grated carrots with a lovely dressing and leek vinaigrette. In the summer, just as a kind of precursor to whatever else there was, there were tomatoes in a salad, and there were cucumber very finely sliced with dill and a dressing. And then, even though they started that way, they always had a green salad after the main course. And in summer, I mean, right now, when I am finished talking to you, I'm going home to do asparagus. And at this time of year, that's always an extra meal, or it becomes the central thing once you add crab and creme fraiche and salmon caviar, or you add fried eggs and parma ham and lots of grated parmesan. But I will always either make that the main deal, or I will sneak them in. I'll make that an extra course. And I do this thing right now. I make lists. This is because I'm such a nerd. I will make lists of kind of like, it's asparagus time. So I'll make a list of all the things that I can easily do asparagus based for supper. And we'll kind of like, then I'll rotate those. The other thing I've been doing a lot recently is, well, once you start to think at this time of year, vegetables, you start to think Middle Eastern, Italian, Asian. And I'm doing a thing I had in Turkey called Haideri, which is slightly drained Greek yogurt. It's mixed with dill and with coriander. And I also put some fresh chili through it so that you keep hitting little bits of, against the coolness, you keep hitting these little bits of heat. But I serve that with beetroot that I've simply, you can either serve it from raw or you can cook it and then slice it. And that's sautéed with cumin seeds. And also we forget about carrots because carrots seem like for the winter, but you've got crunch from those. So I toss that on top as well with that dressing that's got cumin seeds in it. So you've got crunch, you've got softness, and then you've got this heat and this coolness and then the herbs as well. I mean, that's so easy and I love that kind of eating.
Well, it all sounds absolutely delicious. Diana, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Lovely to talk to you, Melissa.
Diana Henry's latest book is How to Eat a Peach, and it has a fuzzy cover. I am a cookbook editor. I am so jealous of how she got that to happen. Melissa Clark's latest is Dinner in an Instant. You can find Diana's recipe for roast tomatoes, fennel, and chickpeas with preserved lemon and honey at splendidtable.org. A few weeks ago, we talked with the chef Dan Barber about a variety of cucumber that he's helping to develop that is so fragrant, he says, you can smell it across the room. And I have not been able to get that idea out of my head since that interview. And apparently neither has my producer, Sally Swift, because she went straight to El Simone at America's Test Kitchen to talk more about cucumbers.
Hey, El, nice to have you here.
Hi, Sally. Thanks for having me.
Hey, I have been thinking about a food trend that I have been seeing more and more of, and I kind of think of it as rough treating your produce. You know, we've been smashing potatoes before we roast them to get those ragged edges. We crush berries and let them sit. We rough grate. My grandmother used to take a whole tomato and just rough grate it on a coarse grater to make a sauce instead of chopping it up.
Mm-hmm.
And I am going to make a prediction here that the salad of this summer is the smashed cucumber salad. And Elle, we are here to have you tell us about it.
Well, I can honestly say that cooks all across the country are far less stressed in their lives because they're getting to beat their food to death.
Always good. So tell us about this recipe. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah, it's called smashed cucumbers. It's also known as pai huang gua, and it's very delicious. It's very simple. It's a great accessory to spicy foods, and, you know, it's quick and easy, and it impresses people.
So why are we smashing these cucumbers?
Well, smashing the cucumbers serves two purposes. First, we're damaging the cell walls, and that makes the cucumber more crisp. Also, it gives the cucumbers more craggy edge, and that helps to hold the dressing better. But smashing it is not where it ends. We actually go in and break the cucumbers more with our hands. And then after that, a little salting happens. Now, if we were to slice these cucumbers, it would get the water out. It would take a little bit more time, the salting process. But because we're smashing them and damaging those cell walls, the salt's getting in there and it's doing that job of drawing out the water in almost half the time.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, what is the optimal technique for smashing?
Well, the optimal technique for smashing is putting the cucumbers in a Ziploc bag and just taking your pan and just giving it a couple of good cracks.
Wow.
Now, you don't want to smush it. Like, you don't want it to become, you know, like just soup. You know, we're not making gazpacho where we're making a salad, you know. So you just want to kind of break it up, you know. So
it's
that
more
it
of
has
a bonk
nice,
than a smash.
More, much more of a bonk than a smash.
This is something you need to have your six-year-old help you out with, I have to say. And what kind of cucumbers work best?
English cucumbers work best. First, because they have less water than American cucumbers.
Okay.
And they naturally are a little bit more crunchy.
And what are English cucumbers? I'm not sure I could even tell you. What are the shiny ones or are they the seedless ones?
They are not the shiny ones because you'll know the difference between English cucumbers because they're less waxy and they're long and skinny.
Okay,
American cucumbers have a tendency to be short and a little shorter and stubby.
Okay, so the cucumbers are smashed and waiting. What are we dressing them with?
So we're making a vinaigrette that has one of my favorite ingredients, Chinese black vinegar. And that's primarily made from rice aged in earthenware crocks to help develop its complexity. It has a very nice, rich flavor. I really love it.
Oh, that sounds delicious on that. And toss and serve this dish immediately?
After you top it with a little toasted sesame seeds, then you serve it.
I'm telling you, salad of the summer.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you, Elle.
Thanks for having me.
Elle Simone is a test cook and food stylist at America's Test Kitchen. You can find that recipe for Chinese smashed cucumbers at splendidtable.org. And that's our show for the week. Thank you for spending the time with us. And until next week, eat well, drink well, and please tip well. Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media, and supported by you. So thank you to everyone who's contributed and made the show possible. We literally can't do it without you. And to help support our show, just head to splendidtable.org. And while you're there, look around. There are tons of recipes, a whole bunch of videos. You can sign up for our email newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen, and it'll make your Monday to Friday cooking a little easier. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast. We have a brand new one called Splendid Table Selects, where we share the interviews and stories that have inspired us, or taught us something new, or just made us better cooks and eaters. Subscribe and leave us a review. Our production team includes senior producer Jennifer Russell. Jennifer J. Lou Lubke is our editor and technical director. Erica Romero is our assistant producer. Chip Walton is our digital associate producer. And Sally Swift is our managing producer and resident cucumber fanatic. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.